Second case for today, 11AP2166, David J. Rosecki versus Monica M. Schissel. Arguing on behalf of David J. Rosecki is Stephen W. Hayes. Now let me call the lineup before we start. You've ceded 5 minutes of your argument to Attorney Todd Hepler, who's the guardian ad litem. And then we will have 30 minutes from Attorney Richard J. Auerbach, who represents Monica Schissel, and 5 minutes in rebuttal by Mr. Hayes. Correct? All right. Mr. Hayes, Attorney Hayes.
Thank you. Honorable Justices, I'd like to introduce Anissa Beckman, who is an associate that worked on the brief. And my clients, Steve and Marcia Rosecki, are seated right here. Krista Miller, the guardian ad litem in the trial court, would you raise your hand so she can, you can be identified? Thank you. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the facts, but I would like to start with a brief discussion of the law. Wisconsin has limited law on this subject, virtually none that directly deals with our set of facts. The case law includes 69.14, which is cited in the brief, and one of the reasons I bring that to your attention is because 69.14 discusses the need for a hearing to determine parental rights. And that's something that ties into the parentage agreement in this case that we'll talk about later. There is another statute that has to do with sperm donation, in effect artificial insemination. That's 89140, which is a form of preconception rule. It's a preconception rule that helps indicate what the treatment of the parties will be in the case of an artificial insemination. In terms of case law, our case law is limited. There is one case that has, I think, some bearing on this case, and that's the LMS case, which is cited, I believe, in all three briefs. It's the only significant surrogacy case that we have. And it actually was a divorce case in which the husband was sterile. He and his wife wanted to have children, thus they agreed that she would have sexual intercourse with another man, and the child that was produced by that act of intercourse would be raised together. The parties eventually didn't get along well, and they sought a divorce. And during the course of the divorce, the husband then sought to distance himself from fatherhood and child support obligations. Both the trial court and the Court of Appeals held that he was indeed going to be treated as the father for cases for the purpose of child support. And he couldn't now turn around and reject the outcome. That is a significant case because, like our case, there was a preconception agreement concerning how the rights of the parties were going to be dealt with later. And that preconception agreement meant that the husband was going to be taking responsibility for the child. We also have a preconception agreement in this case, which
But in that situation, there's a statute that presumes any child born during the course of a marriage is the child of the husband as well as the wife, correct?
That is a correct statement. There is a presumption, a marital presumption that does apply. In effect, by the agreement, but for this agreement, there would have been no child created. And that's basically the same thing we have here. We have a surrogacy agreement or a parentage agreement that was entered into, and but for the parties communicating and entering in that agreement, there would have been no child created in this case.
What do we do, counsel? This case, of course, is tied to its facts, but there may be many cases dealing with surrogacy in this state, and I use the word cases generally. There may be many situations in this state where surrogacy is a fact and there is no agreement whatsoever.
That's true.
And so I'm mindful that anything we do here today has to embrace that situation.
Yes.
Or consider that situation.
Hopefully, at some point, Wisconsin will do as some others have done and adopt some legislation so that guidelines are presented for the parties whether or not there is a surrogacy or a parentage agreement in place. At this point, we don't have laws that help out on that subject. Yes, it is possible that your decision may have implications for non-parentage agreement cases. I would say they may have implications for non-parentage agreement cases where there's no writing, but in almost every case there is an agreement. So you may have an oral agreement virtually in every one of these surrogacy cases. There will have been thought put into the creation of the child. There will have been a plan for the creation of the child. So it's possible, I suppose, you could have no agreement, but I think it'd be very rare that that would be the occasion. Normally you'd have either an oral or a written agreement, and certainly the trend today, because there are a large number of these cases, is for the parties to seek counsel and get a written agreement put in place. So I can't disagree with your statement that, yes, it could have implications that go beyond those cases in which there is a written agreement, but I think in almost every surrogacy case there's going to be some sort of an understanding that's going to be relied upon by the parties. In fact, if you look at cases around the country, that's typically the case. There's been some sort of an agreement. There can be a dispute as to what the contents of the agreement are, but normally the surrogacy matters are based on some sort of an agreement. With the LMS case, the court also talked about the use of promissory estoppel as a means for giving the father responsibility for the child. In that case, there was a promise which the promisor should reasonably expect to induce action or forbearance of a definite and substantial character on the part of the promisee, and which does induce such action or forbearance, and it's binding if injustice can be avoided by enforcement of the promise. And we have basically the same situation here, where there was action originally created by the promises of the parties. It produced the pregnancy. The initial action, I think this case began in 2004, when Monica Schissel, knowing that my clients were not fertile, offered her services as a surrogate. Now, at that time, my clients turned her down and did not go forward. But the parties were thinking about the process as long ago as 2004. Then in 2008, she repeated her promise. At that point, the Rozekis were in the process of a Chinese adoption or trying to get a child through China. And that eventually faded and was replaced by the promises that were made by Ms. Schissel. So they went forward at that point with a surrogacy plan. They discussed the plan thoroughly. They knew what their objectives were. They made themselves pregnant using an injection method, and eventually it produced a child. Before they reached the birth of the child, however, after a couple of months of pregnancy, they went to counsel, spent a good deal of time with counsel devising an agreement. And one of the reasons they had to do that was because Wisconsin has no laws on that subject. So in effect, what they were doing was taking the best preparation they could do to set up a roadmap for how the parties were to behave in the future.
Mr. Hayes, were
yes.
both parties represented by separate counsel?
Yes, they were.
You mentioned earlier that there was a trend toward written agreements. Is there any type of uniform law I know there isn't one in Wisconsin, but is there any type of uniform law in regard to situations such as this?
There are two types of laws. One would be the Uniform Parentage Act, which we have not adopted in full, in part we have. And the other, the ABA has a model act that was produced in 2008 and is part of the appendix of the amicus brief that was filed by Richard Shanebaum. So there are two sorts of acts that you can look to, and they are significant. The ABA Model Act, for example, and one of the issues we have in this case is that we have what we call a traditional surrogacy here. A traditional surrogacy is where the carrier also produces the eggs versus a gestational surrogacy in which the carrier is not producing what they call gametes. So in this case, we have a traditional surrogacy. The ABA Model Act talks about the use of gestational agreements. And if you look at the definition section in the ABA Model Act, they define a gestational carrier as an adult woman, not an intended parent, who enters into a gestational agreement to bear a child, whether or not she has any genetic relationship to the resulting child. And then it specifically says both a traditional surrogate, a woman who undergoes insemination and fertilization of her own eggs in vivo, should be in vitro, and a gestational surrogate, a woman into whom an embryo formed using eggs other than her own is transferred, are gestational carriers. So the ABA Model Act is intended to apply to both traditional and gestational surrogates. And basically what the parties did in this case is what parties have done since Abraham and Sarah used Sarah's handmaiden Hagar to produce a child for them to raise. And indeed, Abraham and Sarah ended up raising the child, Ishmael, in that case. So what was done here isn't unique. What is a bit unique, however, are the advances of medical science in this area. In the last few years, we've seen significant advances which have encouraged the use of assisted reproduction technology methods for family building for those families that cannot produce children themselves.
Is this child currently being visited by his biological mother, as the court described, for a two-year-old child, which would be weekend visits, or is it still very limited visitation?
There are visits that were set forth by the trial court. Initially, when the child, FTR, was born, the child went to the home of the Rezekis. There was some communication between the Rezekis and Monica Sissel early on. We began by petitioning for a temporary guardianship to make sure that there was some official or ability to make decisions on behalf of the child. So a temporary guardianship was granted. A second temporary guardianship, you can get a second temporary guardianship for a second 60-day period, was also granted. In the interim, some contact had been agreed upon and eventually approved by a court. Family Court Commissioner's Office did support the original agreement. So in answer to your question, there's some contact with Monica Sissel at this point. When FTR reached 2 years of age, she was allowed to have an overnight twice a month.
And is that going on? That was my question.
Yes.
Thank you.
Counsel, could I follow up on Justice Bradley's question? She made the point that this case could affect others where there isn't an elaborate 14-page agreement. When I look at your brief, you talk about it is not necessary to terminate the rights of the biological mother in order to get this to go your way. I don't understand how that works. I would particularly not understand it when there wasn't an elaborate agreement.
Well, and actually, it's a question that sends me to another area as well. If you take a look at the decision of the trial court, the court focuses entirely on this issue of termination of parental rights. But if you read the agreement, and we had never petitioned for termination of parental rights in this case. This was brought as a paternity case. But the trial court's decision says, I can't enforce this parentage agreement in effect because it mandates a termination of parental rights. Well, in fact, if you read the agreement carefully, it doesn't mandate a termination of parental rights, but that is one of the options and certainly would have been the expectation of the parties when the agreement was entered into. But there were other choices, one of which we'd already taken advantage of, and that is legal guardianship. So we did have a temporary guardianship established with one extension. The parties wouldn't agree at that point on a permanent guardianship. We continued then litigating the paternity case. Another remedy that would have been available in the agreement would have been a parentage determination proceeding. And I say parentage, not paternity case, because if you look at 6914, I'm assuming the legislature chose its language intentionally. It refers to a hearing to determine parental rights there. Now, that's a birth certificate statute, but it certainly recognizes that surrogacy is alive and well, and there would be a hearing which could determine both paternity and maternity. So in terms of termination of parental rights, yes, it's mentioned in the agreement. Yes, it was an objective of the parties. But this case could have been resolved by guardianship, by a simple custody order using a paternity case, and that's the direction that we took. I don't understand why the trial court focused entirely on this termination of parental rights issue and said, your agreement's no good because this calls for termination of parental rights, when indeed we anticipated there would have been some kind of a court hearing to resolve placement issues in any event. It isn't though you can take a contract and that ends all discussion on the subject. There needed to be some formal determination that Mr. Rozecki was the father, so we initiated a paternity case to do that.
Counsel, following up on Justice Prosser's question, it's a topic on my mind as well. Towards the end of your brief, you outline a possibility that if the court accepts the public policy argument advanced on behalf of the Schissels, that the court could blue line certain parts of the agreement. And I think what we're looking, in other words, excise from the contract those parts that this court may determine run counter to public policy.
You're saying use the severability clause
yes.
in the agreement to excise the offending point that Judge White made about termination of parental rights.
Well, or any part or parts that this court may determine. What in practicality would result? I think that was the gist. If it wasn't the gist of Justice Prosser's question, it's the gist of mine. What would it look like in the real world?
Take out the termination paragraph, and that leaves enforcement of either a paternity case, but basically a determination of the rights of the parties. It would have left in place, for example, there was consideration as a part of this agreement. Basically, she didn't benefit from the agreement or profit by it, but she was reimbursed her expenses. If you simply exclude the section about termination of parental rights, there's still material in there that would benefit Ms. Schissel, and that is she was being reimbursed for certain expenses that she incurred, the drafting fees for the agreement, and other expenses. So there was other material to be enforced other than just that TPR section.
So you would anticipate if that occurred, you would anticipate a hearing or hearings where custody, issues of custody, including shared custody, could be determined?
Yes. Our problem here is that we don't have a statute that was drafted in anticipation of surrogacy placement issues.
Right.
So in the absence of a statute, we take a look at 767, 41, sub 4, and sub 5. This is the paternity section of the statute. So we then filed a paternity action to resolve these issues and took a look at 4 and 5 of 76741, yes.
Ken, let me ask you a practical question. When I've seen this in the trial court, it has arisen in the context of a TPR, and then the parents want to adopt the child. Now, this didn't happen because of whatever reason, so you proceeded in the paternity action, which I get why you would do that. But, you know, in the typical, or is it just me that's thinking this, or is it more typical that TPR does occur, these kinds of arrangements, and then typically the family,
no,
the beneficiary of the agreement is able to adopt the child. Is that the most typical scenario?
Not always. Many of these cases are resolved by bringing a case under 6914, which we deliberately caption as a parentage determination case, because in some of these cases we're seeking to have the intended mother determined to be the mother. So some of these cases come in the context of a termination of parental rights. Some of the cases come in the context of a parentage determination hearing. And most trial courts have been willing to determine both paternity and maternity.
So then the other family does not ever adopt the child?
The intended parents may not have to adopt if they get a determination of parentage.
Okay.
And then
the rights aren't terminated, counselor. They can't adopt the child.
That's,
I mean,
right.
In order to have the, there's no space for a second mother if the first mother's, the biological mother's rights are not concluded either by agreement or by
yeah.
a hearing.
And what we have are determinations that the surrogate is not the mother. So there can be a termination of parental rights. There can be a determination that she's not the mother. For example, if she's not biologically connected to the child, it's not a problem.
This is the hardest, obviously, the hardest kind of surrogacy, because you do have a biological connection. The gestational one, I think, creates difficult issues, but not nearly as difficult as what you bring us today.
I would agree with that.
But the parentage really amounts to them to a TPR. You didn't do it under TPR, but that's what the effect is, the ultimate result is.
That's a correct statement.
Well, but if there isn't a TPR, wouldn't the biological mother always be in a position to keep asking for visitation or other rights?
Well, we probably need to distinguish between traditional and gestational cases, because if it's a traditional case, there would need to be a termination of parental rights. But many of the surrogacy cases we deal with are gestational cases as well, where the carrier isn't providing gametes. So the question initially asked was a very general question about it, and I answered it in a general way. There are different kinds of cases. Some are TPR cases, some are parentage determination cases.
But let me just ask you point blank. If Judge White asks you at some point, what is the authority that I have to terminate biological mother's parental rights, your answer would be?
If she doesn't do it voluntarily under this circumstances like this, there won't be a termination of parental rights. I'm not suggesting that the contract creates grounds for termination of parental rights. Okay? We can't create that kind of a law. And we wouldn't have grounds initially to terminate the parental rights of the mother. So when a case is done as a traditional case, the expectation is it will end with a termination of parental rights and an adoption, which was the expectation in this case. But there are other ways to make the placement with, in my case, Mr. Rozecki and his wife stand, and that would be the paternity case in which there's a denial of visitation rights or secondary placement rights to Ms. Schissel, or the use of a guardianship procedure where guardianship would be applied for Mr. and Mrs. Rozecki. Again, difficult to do, perhaps not impossible, but difficult to do without consents.
Is the birth certificate in this record?
It is not.
Okay. The problem is, without a TPR, what you have is you have a biological mother and a biological father. And the biological father wants to cut off the biological mother from a relationship with the child. I mean, that's the essence of the fight, as I understand it.
I agree.
Okay. And ordinarily in the law, the law would be very reluctant to cut off a biological parent from the child without cause, right?
I agree.
All right. So to persuade a trial court, and maybe to persuade an appellate court, to cut off the usual rights of a biological parent of seeing the child, making decisions for the child, you have to give them cause. So what's the cause?
All right. In this case, we had a trial, and there were two significant statutes that we had to deal with on the paternity subject. The first is 767.41 sub 4. Now,
you referred to that one before.
Yeah, and I'm going to cover just a couple of sentences here, if I may.
Because your red light is on, and thank you. Because your red light is on, and so do it as quickly as
okay.
you can, please.
What I was looking at was the first part, except as provided under sub B, if the court orders sole or joint legal custody under sub 2, the court shall allocate periods of physical placement between the parties in accordance with this subsection. Now, B provides a child is entitled to periods of physical placement with both parents unless, after a hearing, the court finds that physical placement with a parent would endanger the child's physical, mental, or emotional health. Our trial in the trial court had to do with whether or not FTR would have physical or emotional health damage as a result of Monica Schissel having contact with the child. So the first part, and I understand I'm out of time, but the first part of it is examine sub 4. Then we had Dr. Huebner, who was hired as a neutral to do an evaluation and concluded, indeed, that the child, FTR, would have emotional health damage if Monica Schissel had placement rights, okay? Now, we also evaluated sub 5, which are the standard custody and placement factors in a divorce or paternity case. And our position in this case is that if you take a careful look at the judge's opinion and say contrast the judge's opinion with the recommendation of Ms. Miller in her report and how she analyzed all of the factors under sub 5, and how Dr. Huebner analyzed all those factors in sub 5, and then take a look at what the judge didn't do. And I think that the judge did not have sufficient evidence to make the decision he did. I think his decision was clearly erroneous. And
so he had a discretionary decision on custody and placement. And your position is making that decision under 767.41.4 standard clauses, he erroneously exercised his discretion. Period.
Let me expand on that. I believe under sub 4.
Quickly.
I'll expand as fast as I can. Under sub 4, it was clear with the testimony of all three experts that there would be some degree of emotional harm to the child as a result of introducing the risk of Monica Schissel into the equation. Otherwise, you have a typical two-parent family raising a child without interruption, without transport back and forth a couple of times a month, without Monica Schissel calling herself mom and trying to persuade the child that she's the mother. You have none of those issues, and that's why we say there was nothing to lead the court to a conclusion other than that there was emotional harm based on this record. And then if you take a look at the sub five, we don't believe the decision has the beef, okay? The where's the beef at? Doesn't have the beef in it to support the conclusion. There's not evidence to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes. Mr. Hepler?
Good morning, Chief Justices. May it please the court, as guardian ad litem, our position is that the court should find the paternity agreement presumptively enforceable for three basic reasons. One, to provide guidance to people in dealing with these issues in the future. Two, to predict stability, to provide predictability and stability for newborns and what should happen when a child is born. And three, the reason that my position is that this should be a presumptive enforceability is because there are factors that arise that might make it unwise to enforce that agreement, as in my brief, if the process was unconscionable or the circumstances have changed and were unforeseen at the time of the making of the agreement. I'll expound on those a little bit. If I could just correct one issue in Attorney Auerbach's brief on page 4, footnote 1, he alleged that I did not interview witnesses and shouldn't take a position on the parentage agreement. That's not correct. I did meet with the child. I met with the Rozakis. I spent quite a bit of time talking with the previous guardian ad litem as well as the custody evaluator. Those things were all done, and really as a reason, as part of that, I felt it was important to take a position on whether the parentage agreement was enforceable. It seems to me that if the parentage agreement had been followed, most of the problems that have arisen or the issues that have arisen would have been dealt with.
Counsel, this is in many ways an exceedingly complex case. But I think analytically, it's not difficult. And so I'm going to tell you how analytically I see it, and then correct me, because I may be wrong on this. I see this case as you've got an agreement, and that it's conceded that the agreement cannot in and of itself require termination of parental rights, that in order for the mother in a traditional surrogacy, there would have to be a termination, voluntary or involuntary. So any kind of enforcement is not in play in actuality in this case either. Okay. So if you don't have a termination of parental rights after a paternity action, I suppose, if it isn't stipulated. What you have is a 767-41 statutory analysis for a non-marital child, or for a child. This happens to be non-marital, and there are a lot of non-marital children that appear in court, or their parents appear in court, in circuit courts throughout the state, many times, many, many times every day. And you take a look at the factors. The first factor is stipulation of the parties. You see what the stipulation is. Doesn't mean that the court's going to have to be bound by that stipulation, because after all, you're dealing with the child and what's in the child's best interest. And so you have to balance the stipulation and all the other 767-41 factors and come up with the custody and the placement. So that's why I say analytically, it may not be challenging, although the fact situation and the multiplication of issues can be very complex. But in a traditional surrogacy, where there is no termination of parental rights, don't we just look to 760-741 and those factors?
That certainly doesn't meet the goals of Chapter 48 of the Children's Code that calls for permanence and stability to the child. And I would argue that sometimes the best interests of a child are a definite result rather than a best interest contest.
Sometimes the finality, if you will, or permanency, if you want to refer to Chapter 48, is exceedingly important. But I'll tell you, you know, that's a factor. So in order to overcome a trial court's discretionary determination after weighing the facts, you've got to show that his factual findings are clearly erroneous. And isn't that the normal 760-741 appeal? And is it clearly erroneous? And show me where it's clearly erroneous. Isn't that the analytical framework?
I think that's part, but I think the judge was constricted in analyzing the parentage agreement and placing no weight on that. I don't believe the judge gave under sub 1 any weight to that agreement whatsoever, and I think his further decisions were all constrained flowing from that initial determination that the parentage agreement wasn't enforceable in any time. I see my red light is on.
But why did you need a parentage agreement? If you didn't have one, or it was oral and not as detailed as this, you'd go to 767.41. When you break it all down, that's ultimately what the Shevskys are relying on.
But if you determine the parentage agreement is enforceable, you don't have to do that.
Okay, so your position, it's enforceable.
That it's presumptively enforceable unless it's clearly against the best interest of the parties.
Okay, that is your position.
That's my
okay.
Yes, and that's the distinction.
The parentage agreement says, in the event any party seeks to terminate the agreement, notice in writing shall be given. This is all under O. You have not treated this case as a termination of the agreement case, have you?
Not that I'm aware of. That okay. Is not.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Attorney Richard Auerbach, representing Monica Schliss.
Thank you and good afternoon. I am Richard Auerbach, representing the Monica Schlissel, who is present. It's been a quarter of a century since the New Jersey Supreme Court decided the Baby M case. In that case, the learned judge stated, and I quote, "The contract's basic premise that the natural parents can decide in advance of birth which one is to have custody of the child bears no relationship to the settled law that the child's best interest shall determine custody. Whatever the agreement of the party or the parents, the ultimate determination of custody lies with the court." In Mr. Hayes' brief, he labeled that case as dated and oft criticized. And in the amicus brief supporting the appellant's position, there was a citation to the Illinois Gestational Surrogacy Act, which was enacted in 2006. These were cited as evidence that social views of surrogacy are changing. It may well be the case that social views of surrogacy are changing, but I would submit largely with regard to gestational surrogacies and not with regard to traditional surrogacies. Another word we use for gestational surrogate is carrier. Another word for a traditional surrogate is mother. This is a critical difference. For example, during the floor debate on the Illinois Act, the Gestational Surrogacy Act, the sponsor, a woman named Barbara Curry, reassured her colleagues, quote, In a situation where the birth mother provided the egg that results in this baby, there is no way you can't grant her the opportunity to change her mind at the 11th hour.
Counselor, should we treat fathers the same way? Just say the situation was reversed and Mr. Schizel was sterile and Mr. Rozecki volunteered his sperm so that Mrs. Schizel could have a child. And then he changed his mind and said, you know, I thought I didn't want to have kids, but you know what? I really do. And this is my child. I created it. Should we treat him like you're asking us to treat Mrs. Schizel in the same way? The statute that's in place says you have to go through a doctor, but my example assumes they didn't go through a doctor. They were good friends. They didn't need to incur that expense. Would your argument be the same to us?
I believe that under Wisconsin law, the answer is yes. I believe that the philosophical underpinnings of that answer are stronger for the mother who carries the child to term for 9 months, who runs the risk associated with pregnancy, than it is for the man who simply donates sperm in a non-medical but presumably non-sexual donation. There have been questions posed, particularly to the guardian ad litem, about trying to sort of simplify the case from an analytical perspective. And I think that was reasonably accurate. I don't think the answers are quite as simple as that analytical approach would suggest. First of all, and I know Justice Gableman asked questions about severability, which I think kind of tie into this. The parentage agreement does more than call for my client to terminate her parental rights. It provides that she shall have no rights to have placement or custody, and that she shall have no obligation to support the child. If we strip the requirement that she terminate her parental rights from the parentage agreement, we are still left with something that would essentially identify each of those rights, custody, placement, support, and deny those to her, not based on the best interest of the child, but based on the signing of a contract. These are fundamental rights that a mother has, or that a parent has. Procedurally, it's important, I think, to keep in mind how this case was litigated at the trial court level. The appellant filed a motion for specific performance of the parentage agreement. Had that been granted, and it was not, the position taken by appellant was there would be no need for a hearing to determine the child's best interest because the court would virtually, at least, rubber stamp the placement arrangements in the agreement, which would have essentially been Mr. Rozecki cutting out Ms. Schizel from this child's life on a permanent and irrevocable basis. When the judge refused to provide and follow that, he talked about a termination of parental rights not being authorized. I don't know that he meant termination of parental rights under Chapter 48, 48.415 so much as terminating the ordinary and customary rights of a parent, the ones that are fundamentally recognized under both our and the federal constitution, to be involved in the raising of a child. Appellant argues that there is no law in Wisconsin in this area, and I would disagree. There is no law that supports his position. There is no law that addresses specifically traditional surrogacy, but there is a lot of law that supports our position. We have case law and statutes. We have a case that expressly holds that is, one parent cannot impermissibly convey to a third party parental rights, and yet the agreement purports to do that. And that's the ZJH case cited in my brief. We have cases that hold that you cannot bind a party to a custody or placement arrangement until and unless it's court approved. That's 767-34. We have a rule that parties can withdraw from stipulations prior to approval from the court, by the court, and yet a motion for specific performance would have denied my client the right to do so. We have statutes that compel the court to consider relevant factors in the placement of a child contemporaneously with a decision being made. but the agreement would have fixed and made non-modifiable the placement as of the time of the child's conception.
Counsel?
Yes.
It strikes me that we don't really have case law in this area, not because this doesn't happen, but because people generally follow through on the expectations of the parties. So we don't end up in this situation where there's a dispute that arises. I understand the dispute here. I understand the competing interests here. How do we decide this case without messing up all the things that are working right in this area? Do you agree, first off, that the vast majority of these surrogacy arrangements work out without having to duke it out in court?
Yes.
Right.
I believe the amicus brief cites a figure of some 28,000 surrogacies over the past decade and a half or two decades, and we can all go to Lexis and look up the number of cases that have made it to the appellate courts. Researching.
I've only seen the ones that work out.
Yeah.
So that's why I want to make sure that we do no harm here. You know, it's a contract. You could look at it like that. You could look at the traditional statutes. You could look at... But what you don't want, what I think we should worry about doing is we don't want to create problems where none currently exist. If you've got one out of 28,000 cases, that's the problem. Let's not create a problem for the other ones. So how do we decide this case so that we don't create problems and create a new general rule of law that hasn't been necessary until now?
Well, first of all, I am not sure that this case presents the appropriate opportunity to make new law because it is not a gestational surrogacy. And I'm happy to concede that in the area of gestational surrogacies, where there is no biological connection between the person carrying the child and the DNA connection, the law is somewhat ambiguous. But in
I think what I hear you saying is in the area of a traditional surrogacy, you treat it as a paternity, you set custody and placement, and no agreements are ever enforceable.
No agreement, in my opinion, involving a natural parent should be enforceable over the objections of the parent until and unless it is approved contemporaneously by a judge. When we have a situation, say a teenage mother or single mother decides to give her kid up for adoption, enters into a contract with two potential adoptive parents, they're going to pay her medical expenses, etc. It's beyond question that she has the right to change her mind and not relinquish the child for adoption. We can't force her to go through with the contract.
No question.
A simple statement in this case that the traditional mother, surrogate mother, Monica Schissel in this case, cannot be forced to carry through the promise to give up the child resolves that issue. Does the fact that in these adoption cases a teenage mother can change her mind, and some do, mean that the adoption process is destroyed in the state of Wisconsin? Of course not. Adoptions occur all the time. Most of the situations in which two adoptive parents and a pregnant single woman enter into agreements never get the court system because it works. However, I think it is more important to recognize and protect the right of the mother at the time of birth to say, this is my child. I don't care that 9 months ago I agree.
Well, it's
to give
two
up my
people's
child.
It's not just one. There's a father too. There's.
I didn't mean this is my child exclusively.
Okay.
I would note that under Wisconsin law, my client's husband was presumptively this child's father. My client, and we talk about how this fell apart. My client, in a way, did a lot of things in this case to carry out the intent of the party. She surrendered the child to the Rosecki. She stipulated to an initial guardianship. What she did not do was agree to terminate her parental rights and have no involvement.
I'm just trying to get at where your end result is. Do you think in a traditional surrogacy there should be a presumption of joint custody, joint placement? Just so people know what they're getting into.
I'm not sure it is what I think. What I think is that the legislature has enacted a statutory framework that presumes, or as a starting point, joint legal custody and shared placement, and it establishes factors to be applied that may or may not justify varying from that starting point or from that presumption. I think that in a traditional surrogacy situation, when the mother declines to walk away from the child and wants to be part of the child's life, that the courts are compelled to follow the law and apply those factors in a way that promotes the child's best interest.
Okay.
Whether that should be applied to a gestational surrogate who is a mother in a sense of having carried and given birth but not genetically is beyond the scope of this case, in my opinion.
If you prevail, what are your client's long-term goals?
My client testified that she wanted to be a supportive or second parent, that we were not contesting primary placement. As was answered previously, the placement that's currently in effect is one overnight from Saturday to Sunday every other week, where the child comes to my client's home with the half-siblings and her husband, and then is transported back to the home of the Rozeckis. Down the road, I can't really speak what the long-term goal would be, and part of that is because, as with any case involving a child, we don't know what the future holds. Families are delicate. Relationships fail. Health is fragile. Something could happen that would cause any parent to think that the situation that's currently in place is no longer in the child's best interest. There's a presumption of maintaining the status quo. I'm not going to tell you that at no point in time in the future will Monica Schissel attempt to gain additional placement. I'm not going to tell you that at some point in time in the future she might agree to reduce it. What I will tell you is that as the mother of this child, she will act, I believe, in the best interest of the child as she sees that best interest to be.
Also, it seems to me that there are three people that are before the court today. Your client, opposing counsel, and a little boy who's about, 3 years old? Or pretty close there, too, I betcha.
In March.
And I understand your argument on behalf of your client, that she should have a right to change her mind. But, you know, Mr. Rozecki doesn't have a right to change his mind. That's already been done between those two parties. All right? They made up their minds before the child was conceived, and he would not have donated his sperm were it not for her offer to bear a child that he and his wife could raise. Now, he doesn't get to change his mind because you can't take it back, right? But you want to have her change her mind. Well, I have to think about that. But I'm really most interested in what we do, how that affects the child. Because the child didn't make any agreement here. Okay, so if you can focus a little bit on what you think supports what is going on here is really in the best interest of the child, rather than holding both people to their agreement. That's what I'd like to hear about.
Judge White determined that the placement schedule that he ordered was in the child's best interest. In doing so, he necessarily determined that granting the Rozeckis the radical relief that they sought, that is complete termination or cutting off of all contact, no placement, no custody, was not in the child's best interest. The statutes that apply permit the court to make such an order upon a finding that placement would be harmful to the child. I will be the first to concede that there was evidence in the record from which Judge White could have concluded that such harm was likely to occur. That testimony was largely that of the psychologist who testified. It is well accepted that trial court judges are not required to blindly follow expert opinions, particularly when the predicate the opinion is based is infirm or not established in the record. Here, Dr. Huebner, who was a psychologist, listed a number of reasons why she was recommending no placement as being in the child's best interest. One of them rather ironically, was her conclusion that Monica Schissel would not support the role of Marshall Rozecki. I say ironic because it is unusual for the natural mother to be criticized for not supporting the role of the intended mother, if you will, or the stepmother. And it's also ironic because we are here today and we had a two-day trial in front of Judge White, not because my client was trying to keep the child in her home, have her husband determined to be, by the, under the marital presumption, the father, and exclude the Rozeckis, but because she wanted to have a voice. We have the Rozeckis, or Mr. Rozecki, attempting to cut off my client, and my client is the one that was criticized by Dr. Huebner for being unsupportive of the other's relationship. Dr. Huebner went on and criticized Monica in her report and testimony for not stepping back, not letting go of this child, which is pretty circular to say, I want to deny placement because you won't agree to none. In most situations, a parent who says, hey, it's my kid, I don't care, is criticized. But here, Dr. Huebner criticized my client for caring, not being able to say, I have no feelings for this child, which I am one of two natural parents. Even worse, Dr. Huebner testified that my client had nothing to add to this child. And the judge soundly rejected that, noting that she was a good person, her husband was a stable, positive influence, and that the five other half-siblings in her home could have a lot of positive influence on this child's development. To say or to conclude as an evaluator that someone has nothing to add to a child is, and I think was, offensive to the trial court. Dr. Huebner went on and commented on the different parenting styles between the parents, and I'm sorry, but as someone who does mostly divorce work, it is the unusual divided households that have exactly the same parenting styles. And the fact that two households have different parenting styles is not the kind of emotional or psychological harm that justifies saying, well, we're only giving placement to one side and not the other. If that was the case, 90%+ of divorces result in full placement to one party and none to the other. Lastly, Dr. Huebner concluded, and this is really maybe her most important conclusion, that this case presented higher than normal risk to the child because it was, quote, beyond high conflict. This court, as a reviewing court, can examine Judge White's decision to see whether or not his ruling on that point was supported by evidence and rational. And I think the only conclusion that you can reach is that it was. He looked at the attitudes of the behavior of the parties during this entire highly stressful paternity proceeding with motions and attempts to cut people off and all of the tensions that this litigation produced. He found that they had been civil. Those of us in this kind of practice, divorce custody practice, we see restraining orders, we see batteries, we see police calls, we see accusations of alienation, we see all kinds of really damaging, hostile fighting between the estranged parents or sometimes estranged spouses, sometimes they're not married. That wasn't here. None of that was here. Dr. Huebner observed a visit in which my clients came to the Rozecki house to have a visit. She noted how civil everyone was to each other. So while she concluded that this was beyond high conflict, the judge rationally and reasonably rejected that. Now, when an expert says, I believe in X because I think Y is true, when a judge says, I don't think Y is true at all, the judge is perfectly justified in ignoring the conclusion because there's no factual predicate on which it is based. When you review the record, it is undisputed that the judge has a discretionary decision to make. Mr. Hayes argues that it was beyond the great weight of the evidence, and I would submit the standard is whether or not the determination was beyond the great weight of the credible evidence. And if you knock out Dr. Huebner's opinion as factually unsupported and in fact contradicted by many of the facts, there really was nothing much left. Dr. Waldron's opinion was basically affirming by records review what Dr. Huebner recommended. Ms. Miller, the guardian ad litem, the recommendation, as the judge expressly noted, she hitched her wagon to the Dr. Huebner's star. So, barring a finding, an affirmative finding, which Mr. Hayes' client had the burden of proof at the trial court level to show that this child was likely to suffer harm, there was no statutory basis to deny placement. That left the question of how much placement and under what terms. As a brief aside, the finding of risk as opposed to actual harm is what we were talking about here. No one alleged that there'd been any abuse or neglect or any even endangerment in actuality. This was all the psychologist's projection of what might be, this child might experience down the road if certain things continued as she believed them to be. When it comes to risk, I will flatly state every child in the United States is at risk from his parents or her parents. There is that possibility. How minute the possibility is another question. In most cases, the parents also provide a benefit to the child. Being a trial court judge in a custody dispute or a placement dispute isn't simply to identify is there a risk, because the answer is yes. It is balancing risk with benefit. What Judge White did very clearly here is acknowledge that there are some concerns that the child could have some confusion or that the parents could continue to be tense with each other. But he also identified and labeled very clearly the benefits to this child of having two families. What he did not mention, but which are pretty obvious, are benefits such as the potential for financial support, the potential for inheritance, the potential for having a second actual family in case something terrible, catastrophic happened to the Rozekis. But even assuming that everybody goes on their merry ways living healthily, Judge White found a significant benefit to the child having a relationship with my client, having a relationship with her husband, having a relationship with extended family, including siblings. And so it seems to me that while you should be concerned about the best interests of the child, so was Judge White. And his determination, having sat through the 2 days and the previous testimony of the parties in the specific performance motion hearing, which was also somewhat evidentiary, and having considered all the evidence, was to make the finding that he did.
Counsel,
yes, sir.
On page 6 of your brief, you cite Wisconsin Statute 948.24. At the top of the page. Were you seriously suggesting that the Rozekis committed a felony in this case?
No.
Why did
what I'm suggesting
that?
Is that had they carried out an adoption and paid to Monica the sums that the parentage agreement required that they pay, the Rozekis and my client would all have committed felonies as it is technically defined under Wisconsin law, not just the Rozekis. That there are provisions in the parentage agreement that called for payments that the adoption statute does not allow. And 948.24 makes adoption when there is a payment not authorized by statute in order to bring about an adoption a crime. Now, no one was seriously.
So are you saying that all of the payments that were made by the Rozekis to the Schizels were not illegal?
Sorry,
they were not illegal. They were all legal.
Okay. Analyzed from an adoption contract perspective, which would be the kind of contract that you would have with a single mother giving up her child for adoption at the hospital, the law permits certain types of payments. The law limits those payments to the ones that are enumerated in the statute. The parentage agreement contained many, and perhaps all, but at least many of the authorized payment provisions in the adoption statute, such as paying for the health expenses, paying for the certain lost wages of the mother. It, however, went beyond that the consideration in that agreement went beyond what is legally authorized to include payment of Corey Schissel's, the husband's, lost wages. That, for example, is not permitted. It is a violation of law to pay that. Was it paid? No. Was there an adoption? No. Is anyone at criminal risk? No. I cited that because when the parentage agreement contains illegal provisions, it affects whether or not estoppel should be applied. The basic reason estoppel in this case shouldn't be applied is because estoppel in Wisconsin, I don't believe, has ever been applied offensively to deny someone the right to assert parental rights. It has been applied defensively to preclude a party from asserting that they were not the parent. A father, to me, a man who assumes a support obligation by his conduct by payment cannot later say, well, I found out I'm not the dad. I already assumed this. So he can be stopped from denying paternity. But no case that I'm aware of has ever said in Wisconsin that someone in Monica's situation is stopped from claiming I am the mother because she signed an agreement saying that she wouldn't.
I think in In Re, CAS and CDS, though it wasn't perhaps estoppel, a punitive father of a child born during the course of a lawful marriage was prevented from asserting his paternity by virtue of having blood tests taken to determine if it was his child. And the court determined it was in the best interest of the child to hold up the presumption of paternity so that the statute provides when a child is born during the course of a lawful marriage. So though they may not have used the word estoppel, he certainly was prevented from having his paternity determined, and he was trying to assert his paternity in that action.
I think that is almost the exact opposite of estoppel. There, the genetic father who was trying to assert his paternity was blocked by the marital presumption.
By the best interest of the child, too, I think.
That's within that marriage, yes. The statutes on paternity, when a woman is married at the time of conception, gives the court the right to decide that if it's in the best interest of the child to maintain the marriage and not adjudicate the non-marital father, the court can do that. Again, we get to a best interest standard. There is a difference, I think, also, Justice, between having a hearing on whether it was in the child's best interest to have the husband of the mother or the biological father be deemed the child's father for legal purposes, and saying that as a matter of law, you don't have a hearing because here's what we're saying the father is.
You had a hearing here, though.
Under the motion for specific performance, the hearing would have, had the motion been granted, been limited to what does it say, where do I sign the court order that says no
place.
Yeah,
but that's not what happened in this case. In this case, there was a full hearing. At least that was my understanding.
There was, and we supported that. That's what we sought, was a full hearing to determine the child's best interest. My light's up, but my point is that the parentage agreement in a traditional surrogacy cannot and should not, under the principles of Wisconsin case law and statutes, be given enforceability because it would strip the fundamental right of a mother, in all senses of the word, to ask for custody or placement in the best interest of the child.
Mr. Halbach, I recognize your time is up, but I want you to briefly explain again why you don't think a simple analysis under 767.41 applies in this case. Yeah, I thought that was your
decision. Yes, I did probably not answer that question as well as I should have. The framework for the analysis is established in 767.41, the supply of the factors. Where it gets tricky is questions about whether, as the guardian litem alleges, the intent of the parties as expressed in the parentage agreement should be given presumptive effect, whether it should be given, it should be admissible, the weight to be placed on that. Now, sub one, which has been cited by the justices here, talks about the wishes of the parents.
And a stipulation is set forth.
I interpret, arguing in my brief, that that section relates to stipulations in the divorce or paternity proceedings that are typically marital settlement agreements or partial marital settlement agreements, not what the parents may have talked about or agreed before the birth of the child. We have cases all the time where a man fathers a child, isn't married, and urges the woman to have an abortion. And yet when the child is born, is there and wants to be the dad. And we don't say, hey, you didn't want this child, you don't get to have custody and placement rights. We look at the stipulation, the court is supposed to give weight to what the parties come before the court to say, we are in agreement, we are this child's parents right now, here's where we are. This is something we've reached in the court. The judges review those to make sure there's nothing obviously violative of the child's best interest. But there's a public policy between parents, supporting parents getting along and enforcing stipulations and adopting them whenever possible. Now this stipulation, it's not clear to me at all, qualifies as such a stipulation. It is a written agreement that was signed at this point 7 months before the child was born, the oral agreement being 9 months or 10 months before the child was born. So, and it's only one of 15 or so factors. So there are some nuances that make, I think, complicate this. Judge White did not allow into evidence in the best interest phase, if you will, of the trial, the actual parentage agreement. And that's something that Mr. Hayes faults him for by claiming that exclusion was not appropriate. However, if you look at the record, Judge White considered, well, first of all, he knew all the terms because he'd had the previous hearing. There was testimony from both of the parents, from Marcia Rosecki, from Dr. Huebner at length about the terms. The whole discussion, testimony of Dr. Huebner about whether my client should have honored the agreement, whether she was justified in withdrawing from it, bearing in mind that she had anticipated a role in this child's life that she had been told in the middle of her pregnancy wasn't going to happen. It's clear that the judge was very aware of the terms. And lastly, and I, with the court's indulgence with my red light on, if you look at the bottom line here, the placement that my client got was something less than 10%. It was relatively, I won't say nominal because it's an overnight, but it was minimal placement, one out of 14 overnights. Given all of the factors here, the only factors that would support such a skewed award of placement, so much to the Rosakis and so little to the Schissels, is in fact the sort of the intent of the parties that they would be the primary home. He carried out that portion, and for the Rosakis to claim that even that was an abuse of discretion, I think should be rejected. Thank you for your time.
I thought, Mr. Auerbach, that you'd get into the Holtzman issue. Could you return to the microphone, please? I thought, Mr. Auerbach, that you'd get into the long discussion in Holtzman that 767 didn't apply unless you had an action affecting the family. And that, and the standing of the parties, but.
Had this case been initiated by Marcia Rosecki, those considerations I think would have been very valid. There is a Colorado case where, the court and a different statute, but did give some recognition to an intended mother as a legal participant.
Okay.
This case, because it was started as a paternity.
By the father.
We were in 767. There's no question that a paternity is not an intact family, and so we didn't get there.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Hayes?
Let me start by responding to some of the fact comments that were made that I don't agree with. There was some discussion about the Illinois law, not a fact subject at this moment, but the Illinois law is narrower than the ABA Model Act, which is now being proposed, and that does not treat the Illinois Act is a gestational surrogacy act intended to apply to gestational surrogates. The ABA Model Act clearly applies to traditional surrogates
as do the laws in several states. I will acknowledge that the laws on this subject are scattered, not concentrated, and it makes this case much more difficult. There are cases that have enforced the rights of intended parents over traditional surrogates. There are cases where traditional surrogates have prevailed. So when you go outside the state of Wisconsin to look for authority, it isn't particularly helpful. You do have the Baby M case, which was really at the infancy or the very beginning of what we call assisted reproduction technology. New Jersey has drafted a new law that allows surrogacy, which was vetoed by Governor Christie a short time ago. My understanding is that they're working out some details there. But times have changed since the Baby M case. Frequency of the use of surrogacy has increased dramatically. Now, on the subject of long-term goals, in the statement that Monica Schissel has never really pursued primary placement, that is not the case. And if you look at even the report of Dr. Kane, their witness, she said that she was pursuing primary placement. The same appears in the report of Dr. Huebner. So that is simply not a fact. They began by pursuing primary placement. One of the problems we had with this case is that her position changed consistently and was very difficult to figure out exactly what direction she wanted to take here. And that's why I think you need agreements and you need to enforce agreements. So there is a predictable path for the child in this case. And we haven't been talking a lot about the child. A lot of it's been talking about Monica's rights. But it's apparent under sub 4 of 76741 that emotional harm to the child is a critical determinant in terms of custody. And frankly, when you're talking about, we didn't expect with this agreement that we would get a termination of parental rights unless it was voluntary. We anticipated that there would be some kind of a court hearing, and as I mentioned before, it could have been a paternity hearing where you're talking about placement rights, it could have been guardianship, it could have been a parentage determination hearing. Now, there was a statement made that I think was incorrectly taken by Judge White from Dr. Huebner, and the statement was that Monica Schissel will add nothing to the child's life. The statement was, her presence will add nothing to the quality of his life at this time, and she does encourage the Rozekis at some time in the future to make some connection so that the child is aware of his past, and that's something they testified that they would do. So if you look at her report on page 27, you will get clarification of that statement, which the judge, I think, incorrectly relied on. Now,
what's our question? Is our question here today, did the circuit court erroneously exercise, or was there an erroneous exercise of discretion in entering the order and judgment entered? Is that?
I believe the decision was made without evidence to support it.
Which would
clearly
be
erroneous.
Okay, clearly erroneous. And so, in other words, this is the way I think I see it. Best interest of the child is the touchstone. Do you agree with that or disagree with that under 76741, which you cite in subfloor and 5?
Yes, but if I can qualify that, if I could. Best interest of the child is the touchstone, clearly under sub 5, where the subject best interest is stated. It says this is to evaluate, these factors are used to evaluate the best interest of the child. But you can't ignore sub 4, which says a child is entitled to periods of physical placement, et cetera, unless a placement with a parent would endanger the child's, and we'll just say, mental or emotional health. It's sort of a best interest factor, but it's treated separately. So if you look at the statute literally, you can cut off your analysis with sub 4 when you determine, if you're the trial judge, that there would be physical, mental, or emotional health danger to the child, which is exactly what the experts opined in this case. And it's not limited in this case to Dr. Huebner. And I think that one thing that don't think is fair to the guardian ad litem is to say that she hitched her star to Dr. Huebner with nothing else. I want to direct your attention to the report of the guardian ad litem, who carefully analyzed all of the factors that are required under 767.41 sub 5. And also take a look at the report of Dr. Huebner, who carefully analyzed all of those factors, and compare that with the decision of Judge White, who did not carefully analyze all those factors. In fact, a couple of cases that I am going to mention, I'm able to mention them but not cite them as precedent under Minnesota law. But take a look at the ALS and baby boy A cases. I think they're relevant in terms of the thinking you should engage in when analyzing this case. Let me answer one other question because my time is fleeting here.
No, it's gone.
Am I done?
You're done.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes. Indeed, I want to thank... pardon me?
Could I ask one question?
You're not done, Mr. Hayes.
Maybe I'm Justice, grateful, maybe I'm not.
Justice Prosser.
Sure.
No doubt you are competent counsel, but is there a source that we could look to for large parts of this parentage agreement? I mean, you just didn't devise this out of whole cloth, did you?
There is a group called the American Academy of Adoption Attorneys, and they have an assisted reproduction technology section, of which I am a member. The attorneys around the country share information at conferences that lead to the production of documents like that. I believe that Richard Shanebaum, who submitted the amicus brief on behalf of the Academy, attached a type of agreement. I don't think it's totally identical to the one that's been used here, but a type of agreement that has been used in Wisconsin as a sample. So, I mean, the intent of the agreement is to be, and you can tell it by reading it, to be meticulously thorough and try and project any possible outcome and provide a solution for whatever happens.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Now done. I want to, on behalf of the court, thank you, Mr. Hayes, you, Mr. Heffer, and you, Mr. Harbach, for a fine briefs and excellent discussion of this obviously a case on the forefront of medical technology and the relationship of medical technology or science and the law. So this ends our hearing on 11AP 2166, David J. Rosecki versus Monica M. Schissel.